Thanks, Don, and thanks for everyone that's joined us here in Minneapolis and everyone that's joined us here online. This has been a great symposium so far, and it's really nice to be a part of it. So today I'm going to share with you some information about a specific project, an exciting project that we've been part of for the last 5 years in southeast Minnesota. The project's the Root River Field to Stream Partnership. And at the heart, it's a water quality monitoring project and a conservation planning project. Today, I'll talk about a little bit of the background, where we're working in the state, give some context for folks that are outside the state. I'll talk about the type of data we've collected over the last 5 years, and I'll also talk about the partnerships. And that's been brought up many times throughout this morning's conversation, but is critical and important to this project. So the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is the lead for the Root River Field to Stream Partnership, and we work really closely with local government partners, nonprofits, and industry. The founding partners are the Nature Conservancy, the Minnesota Ag Water Resources Center, and for those that aren't familiar, Minnesota Ag Water Resources Center represents many of the main commodity groups here in Minnesota, and it's kind of the water quality arm of many of those commodity groups. Monsanto, and we also work with Fillmore, Maurer, and Houston County SWCDs. And critical to this partnership and shown on this slide is some of our producer partners. So we work with four individual producers and their families that actually host our sites and host our edge of field monitoring equipment. And they have, and I'll talk about this throughout, but provided a lot of feedback on the entire process, data delivery, how the information's conveyed. They've been part of a core technical advisory team and really been critical to the development of this project and kind of fact-checking what we're doing and how we're delivering that information out on the landscape. As we move forward, we're developing additional partnerships with ag retailers and co-ops in this area. And I'll say one lesson learned up front is just the time required to really build meaningful relationships in these types of projects. So 5 years into the partnership, we're seeing new collaborations, new cooperation at the local level, and we're really excited about the next 5 years because it's really built a lot of trust and a strong foundation that I think is going to serve us well as we move into the next phase of the project. So the Root River Field Stream Partnership began in 2009. We consider it a mid to long-term scale project. 5 years in, we're at a halfway point, so it is planned to be a 10-year project. The purpose is to evaluate the impact of ag practices on water quality. And what we do in order to really evaluate those impacts and look at the effects of agriculture in this area is use edge of field monitoring. So as you can see in the upper right-hand corner, we set up monitoring equipment right at the edge of operating fields. We set up fiberglass flumes, as well as that monitoring equipment you see in that green box. This is very sophisticated monitoring equipment that we set up here. It's automated sampling, so every time runoff occurs, samples are collected. Those samples are analyzed for nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment, as well as the volume of runoff that occurs at those fields. Additionally, we have in-stream locations where we are also collecting water samples and analyzing those samples. The idea is to gather this data and work with the producers to influence some of the farm management decisions. Also to evaluate the effectiveness of conservation practices that are put on the land as part of this project. So as far as evaluating those practices, we consider kind of a pre and post set of data. The first 5 years, we were collecting a lot of baseline information. Now we're working to put practices out on the landscape and then continuing that monitoring to collect information to see if we can see any responses in our water quality data. And as far as enabling better management, that's really where it comes down to working with those individual producers, talking about their management strategies. And already we've seen the response to this accurate, kind of robust local data set. So right off the bat, when you're working with producers like this, there's a response to the numbers that they see when They see during a big storm event sediment come off their field, or a loss of nitrogen that they paid for come off their field. And so just as a few examples, we've seen cover crops be implemented as a practice on an individual field after a year with considerable sediment loss. We've also seen a grass waterway be improved when it became apparent that that maybe wasn't functioning up to the level that the producer thought. So this is considered a watershed scale project. So we look at the entire Root River watershed. This is a 1 million-acre area in southeast Minnesota, and we divide that generally up into three areas. So we have three areas that we're working in, and each of those represents a different region. So as you can see, we have small watersheds that we've delineated, minor watersheds or sub-watersheds, in each of those general regions. And those are referred to as the headwaters, sub-watershed, Crystal Creek, and Bridge Creek. Each of those is less than 5,000 acres in size. And so in total, working in those areas, we're working with 50 producers on 500 fields and 10,000 cropped acres. And together, we look at those three watersheds and we feel they're representative of this area of southeast Minnesota. We've dissected it, and then looked at the smaller areas to give us information that's applicable to the larger area. So a little bit about the agricultural production. All three watersheds are dominated by ag production, but each is a little bit different. Starting in the west with the headwaters watershed, this is by far our flattest watershed in this particular area, and with the largest fields, dominated by corn and soybean production, and we see some tile drainage in that area. That's pretty different than Crystal Creek and Bridge Creek. As you move further east, you move into the driftless region of Minnesota, where there's karst features, so a limestone bedrock, underground caves, sinkholes, and disappearing streams. So that is a much there's more rolling hills, bluffs in that landscape, so the fields tend to be much smaller, irregular in shape. And as you can see from the graph at the bottom, you get a little bit more crop diversity there, more alfalfa, there's more dairies in that area, more pasture land. So all of them vary, but are overall representative of this area of southeast Minnesota. So that gives you a little bit of a sense of where we're working in the state and the backdrop and the landscape of our study area. So the driving questions for this project is, what's the water quality like today? So what is the baseline conditions that we're starting with for this project? What's the range of sediment and nutrient losses? What do we see across the fields that we're working on? What's the range and what are some of the trends that we're seeing across multiple years of data collection? It's been a good 5-year period to be collecting information in this area. We've had variation in our weather. So we've had years where we've had floods and extreme rainfall. We've had years with drought and not much rainfall. So we've actually gotten quite a variety of weather conditions and nothing that fits quite the norm. So it's been nice to have all of that data within a single project and start to really understand some of those trends. Additional questions, how effective are new and existing conservation practices? And then what's the best approach to engage the producers and deliver cost-effective conservation? So to answer these questions, we divided this project, or this 10-year period, into two phases. So the first phase was focused on intensive baseline water quality monitoring. So again, you'll see these edge-of-field flumes that are collect samples whenever the runoff occurs. This gives us a good idea of when runoff occurs and what's moving off the fields during those different events. What's the intensity and magnitude of those runoff events, and what time of year. So you can see we're monitoring year-round at these sites. And all of this effort to really get a very reliable and robust data set that we can use to engage further conversations about conservation and really have a localized data set that's local to that watershed, where we can work with producers and they feel like this is information that was collected in their own backyard. And the second phase is more about what do we do about some of the water quality concerns that we are in the area. So how do we get more conservation out on the landscape? How do we work cooperatively to improve the conservation practices that are already there, and then to implement additional practices in targeted areas? I'll talk a lot about this process today, but I'll just mention that what you see in the picture here is a dedicated technician that was part of our program. He's retired from the local SWCD, so has a good reputation, has been working in the area. We talked about this morning, the importance of having established relationships. So bringing someone that knows the area really well. He's a technical service provider, so has that expertise about conservation delivery. He became part of our project team and worked with the interested producers to actually go out and walk those fields. So this is him doing some assessments, some follow-up during last spring, which was the first year in our phase two. So far, we have 5 years of data, 365 days of year we're monitoring, so it's year-round automated sampling. And I just bring this to the attention because this differentiates our program from some other programs. This monitoring throughout the year, and really what we've been able to do by having the equipment out all year is capture some of the early snowmelt runoff, which we've found is a very critical time for runoff in Minnesota. So just give a little acknowledgement to our local partners and all the staff that go out when the weather forecast tells us that there might be a thaw and we could get some runoff events on frozen soils. This is clearing out the flumes, clearing them out of ice and snow, freeing that up so we have a clear channel if that runoff does occur. So there's a lot of effort and participation by a lot of local partners to really make this happen and to make a data set that we're confident in 365 days a year. So in other areas of the country, this wouldn't be a problem, but here in Minnesota, this is something that, you know, we really have to plan for and address. So over the last 5 years, we have collected a large amount of data as part of this project. And an important part of the project is data management and quality control. So as you can imagine, as the data is coming in and we're monitoring every individual event, that really accumulates to a very large data set. So we'll slice and dice that data in a lot of different ways. We're really interested in looking at individual sites by year, individual sites over years, looking at all of our sites in a single year. We break it down by month, looking at months where we see most of the runoff activity occur. We also look at individual storm events. So we can look at, dissect an individual storm event and look what's happening at the beginning all the way to the end of those storm events. For the purposes of today's presentation, and because we don't have too much time together, I'm just going to present some very, average data. So what I have up on the screen here is averaged across all sites and by all years. But I wanted to mention some of the detailed data that we do have. It's available on our website, and I'd be happy to tell people where that is at the end of the presentation. So talk a little bit about, you know, what we are seeing. As far as runoff, about 10% of the precipitation that falls on an individual field comes off as runoff. And that's what we've seen in this project. It's actually compares nicely to other edge-of-field monitoring sites in the upper Midwest, where we've seen about 8 to 12% of the precipitation that falls comes off the field as surface runoff. And 50% of the runoff that occurs in this watershed occurred during frozen ground conditions. So when that ground is frozen, it's saturated, the water has nowhere to go. At least 50% of our runoff occurred during that time. One thing to note about nitrate loss over the surface water here tends to be a little bit lower than what we've seen in some other edge-of-field monitoring programs at 1.2 pounds per acre. And the reason for that is we are just monitoring the edge-of-field surface losses. And so in this area of Minnesota, we know from other studies that we've done and other studies that others have done that much of that nitrate loss is lost through leaching to groundwater. So this doesn't quite capture all of the nitrogen budget or the nitrogen loss on that field. Another thing to notice as we look between the field and the stream data set, we can see that the field loss of sediment is higher than what's indicated within the stream. And so what we know is that the sediment that leaves the field, not all of that is being delivered directly to the stream. Some of that is because of natural processes where the sediment falls out of that water prior to reaching the stream. Additionally, in southeast Minnesota, we know that there's effective conservation practices. There's some big sediment control basins in this watershed, and so this is indicating to us that those are working in a sense and capturing some of the sediment that's lost at the edge of the field and is not ultimately delivered to the watershed. Something that's been interesting for us is to look at the monthly losses, and a statistic such as 4 months out of the year accounted for more than 90% of our annual losses. And this is across all sites and all years. So we know that March, April, May, and June are the critical times for runoff. So this is really important to think about what type of practices we put on the ground and making sure that those are effective at that given time. It was mentioned this morning about the episodic nature of runoff from agricultural fields. We get big delivery of nutrients and sediment off a field in single events. And so thinking about how do we manage for those maximums, and in addition to thinking about how do we manage for average amounts of runoff. One thing I'll point out here is looking at losses in May and June. So during May and June, we have about 31% of our runoff coming off the fields. That's contributing 71% of our phosphorus and almost 90% of our sediment. So those 2 months alone are when we're losing the majority of our sediment and phosphorus from the field. So again, thinking about critical timing and how practices match up with the timing of those with the timing of losses. In this particular watershed, about 85% of our sediment loss or phosphorus loss is with sediment. So it's mostly a particulate sediment loss in this watershed, as opposed to in other areas of the state where we see a kind of a 50-50 split between the dissolved and the particulate phosphorus. So on average, there's about 20 runoff producing events per year, and one or two of these events contribute to about 50% of our losses. So again, we've got one or two very big events that are contributing the majority of our nutrient losses. As mentioned, about 50% of the total annual runoff occurs when the ground is frozen, so those months of February, March, and April. Over 90% of the nutrient sediment loss occurred in those four months, and to date, we've had no runoff been observed in November and December. So again, as part of this year-round monitoring, we start to pull out information like this that really helps us as we go out and talk to producers about time of vulnerability on their fields. And then 84% of the phosphorus is associated with sediment. So this information's been collected over the last 5 years through our very intensive edge of field and in-stream monitoring. And it's important to note that we will continue with that monitoring over the next 5 years. So we've now added an additional layer of activities to our project, but this monitoring will continue throughout, and we'll have a 10-year data set in just 5 years. So moving into phase two of the project, and this was started this past spring, I'll walk through what we're calling a step-by-step conservation planning process, and then go into a little bit more detail about some of these individual steps. So what was started last spring was taking an inventory of all the fields. So we are working with 50 different producers, 500 fields in our three sub-watersheds. So generating maps and information about what conservation practices already exist in this area. So what is already out on the landscape that we should know about? And then going out and validating those practices that are out on the landscape. So looking at aerial imagery and then driving around the watersheds and actually validating that those practices are still there. Using digital terrain analysis tools to really start to pinpoint areas of the watershed that are most vulnerable to erosion. I'll talk about that in detail. And then creating individual field maps. So what a producer really wants to know is, you know, what's important for an individual field and then all their fields together as far as their operation. And so these first three steps are really in the office type of activities. We had some contact with the producers. You know, they were aware that they're within the Root River Partnership project area, and so we have communication through newsletters, meetings, outreach events. But actually, as we collected this information, we didn't have to interact with the producer all that much. Much of this information is, it's digital. It's, you're at your computer really doing a lot of this background work for the producer, for the client. So a lot of this was done at the within the office over the winter months. And then we sent letters to the landowners letting them know what an update on the project and that we were interested in working with each of them on an on-farm walkover. So we sent letters to those producers along with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and probably more effectively, our partner farmers sent letters to their neighbors talking about the project, talking about their experience working on the project, some of the things they've learned, and generally asking their neighbors to keep an open mind about doing an on-farm walkover, that it may be valuable to them. So letters went out to the landowners. For those that were interested, on-farm walkovers, in-field assessments, creation of an individual action plan. So what do you do with all this information, and how much information do you actually send out when you've got, you know, files and maps and data? Follow-up meetings. So what next? So what comes out of all of this action and planning? And then signing letters of intent. Actually, once presented with all the information, how interested was an individual producer to implement the conservation practices that were identified? So I'll just start a little bit with some conservation planning tools that we used. And I just want to mention these because they were so important to us as the project team to start to really understand, understand our watersheds and be able to identify those critical areas. So the Ag Conservation Planning Framework was one of a few tools that we used. This uses soils data, land use data, and high-resolution topographic data as inputs. And as you can see on the map on this slide, areas in red or fields in red are those that are most vulnerable to runoff. So again, we get a nice visual that starts to focus in on areas of higher and lower priority concern. I'll mention this is one of many tools. This is kind of an area of a lot of activity right now. There's a lot of people developing useful tools, and we see the application of many of those tools. At some point, you pick the ones that work for you, you pick the ones that you have access to and that you really like the output from. So I'll talk about a few, but just know that there's many kind of at our fingertips now for those that are really good with GIS. So that's the other key, is to have someone in your office that, or someone at the local Soil and Water Conservation District that can actually work with these maps. The second is something called the Stream Power Index. This is a complementary tool. The information that's considered in the Stream Power Index is the slope of the field and the size of the drainage area. So really it's taking landscape features and saying what is the potential risk of erosion based on just that slope and then the area that's contributing water, or that catchment area. So again, this gives us another kind of refined look at our landscape and starts to pinpoint some of those same areas that we saw at the last tool as those highly vulnerable areas. With this tool, we can start to actually look at those SPI values and start to apply some statistics that allow us to make statements about, you know, the usefulness of these tools. So working with a statistician, analyzing this data, for our data set, we were able to start to come up with some statements about the odds of erosion. So it's really a risk of potential erosion. So that could increase by 4% for every 1 unit increase in SPI. So again, we start to quantify some of the potential risks that are out on the landscape. Also, we were able to look across all of our 3 sub-watersheds, and through this analysis, it was indicated that for Bridge Creek and Crystal Creek, because those have steeper slopes and in those areas, the potential for erosion was 8 times greater than the headwaters. So you start to frame some of this information in a way that makes sense to someone outside that's just not necessarily using this tool. So once we developed these maps and had an idea of where we wanted to look in these fields for potential risks, we sent out letters to all the producers and waited for those producers to call back if they were interested. So we started in 2 of our 3 sub-watersheds. So we have a group of 50 farmers. It was narrowed down to 31 farmers in 2 of those 3 watersheds. 30 of those producers called the team back and said that they'd be interested in having the technician come out. So over the last year, we've completed 30 field walkovers, and that's 100% of the crop acres in Bridge Creek and Crystal Creek. So in a lot of cases, they didn't walk, they rode a four-wheeler, but they did go over the whole perimeter of the field. In some cases, the farmer said to the technician, "You can go out there. I'm not really that interested in seeing the fields I see every day." In other cases, that farmer wanted to go with the technician and actually walk those fields. More often than not, the areas that were indicated on the map were the areas that farmers already knew were trouble spots on their farm. These are areas that had drowned out in different years, the areas where the yield tended to be lower. So these weren't really surprises, but it's kind of a validation process of some of that potential risk. And in many of the cases, the producers already had ideas about what they'd want to do on these areas. So really, this whole process is something that supports conversations about what is possible out in these very critical areas. And it's conversations that are supported by science, because now we have the water quality data at the edge of the field. We have all of these maps. So we're really refining it and coming with a portfolio of information that reinforces some observations that are already going on in the landscape. So following the field walkovers, the technician took about 2 days to type up the notes and create a report for each of those individuals. And there are kind of two important things in that report. First is, what type of practices are recommended for that individual operation? Second is, what is the cost of those practices? So first, the practices themselves were identified as high, medium, and low priority. So some of those highest priority practices, ones we wanted to see get on the ground right away as part of the project. A timeline for that, what we're working with producers is, in the next 2 years, we're really hoping to address those highest priority practices, put a time frame of five years or so to address some of the other practices. Some of these practices come with a big price tag, and so thinking about these over multiple years is a helpful way to eliminate the shock of some of the reports. The other important thing is really the cost, being really upfront with what is the cost of the conservation practices. And I should reiterate that these are just structural and vegetative practices that we're talking about now. So this whole process is really focused on those structural and vegetative practices. There's another component to the project that focuses on nutrient management, and that is where we're developing relationships with local co-ops and ag retailers. It's an important part of the project, but not mentioned here. And then these reports were delivered to each of the producers. But before we sent them out, we actually tested them with our edge of field producers and said, you know, what type of information is most critical? And the feedback we got was really keep it simple. What we want to know is what needs to be done. We included some maps in the original reports, and some of the feedback was, you know, this is more information than I want right away. And so having the information kind of in the background and at meetings was useful, but when we send out the report, the idea was to keep it simple and focus on what the practices were and what the cost was. So overall, with the field walkover results in two of the three sub-watersheds, we identified $1.1 million in conservation needs. That's for 150 potential projects were identified, and 40% of those costs were considered a high priority. So 40% of those costs is what we'd like to see addressed in the next 2 years. About 50% of that total cost of $1.1 million was associated with manure and feedlot projects. So those are really our big ticket items. And you can see on the breakdown on that chart, about 62% of the overall cost, more or less, is associated with those manure and feedlot practices. So for some producers that have a dairy and have that, their price tag looked a little bit different throughout this entire project. Most common practice overall was a grass waterway, and 60% of the waterways and structural costs were classified as a fix versus a need, which was really interesting to us. And here's an illustration of that, which is that there's already conservation practices out on the landscape. Just over time, they may have not been maintained, or they've been eroded. So their functionality isn't as good as it could be. And so in many cases here, what we're talking about doing is actually just fixing something that's already there. So there's been experience working, you know, with the grass waterway there. Now the sides have eroded. You can see where the gullies have formed there. So it's just about reshaping, redesigning, and getting this up to a standard. So the last step, and I'll finish up with, so what do we do from here? Actually getting practices out on the landscape. So working again through our project team, working with our local SWCD, working right now with our local NRCS office on EQIP contracts. So how do we move through all this planning process to actually see these practices out on the landscape? Well, we had 30 producers that were interested in an on-farm walkover, and 85% of those farmers, after they received their reports, have signed a letter of intent. And that letter of intent says that if we're able to work with them to get the cost share dollars for those practices, they're willing to put in their share and put those practices on the landscape. So we have upwards of 12 NRCS contracts that will be signed this fall as part of this project. And that's because of secured targeted EQIP funding. And that is actually was mentioned this morning, the Mississippi River Basin Initiative, which targets money to specific watersheds in Minnesota. Two of the three, actually all three now, sub-watersheds are part of that initiative and get targeted funding. So we're able to apply for those dollars in partnership with NRCS and the local SWCD office. Also, our project team's applying for other grants. We're applying for state dollars. We're applying for private dollars to support further cost share. And with that, I'll just say thank you. Website, which will get you generally to our Clean Water Fund website, and lots of information about this project and other projects.
Thank you, Margaret.